Hello and welcome to the Full of Beans podcast, hosted by myself, Hannah Hickenbotham. Throughout these podcast episodes, we will speak to a range of individuals about their experience of eating disorders, with the aim of increasing awareness and understanding whilst reducing stigma and isolation. Please note that the topics discussed in this podcast may be triggering for some individuals, so tread lightly, check in with yourself, and reflect on these conversations. In this week's podcast, I'm joined by Kevin Jarvis. Kevin is a disabled, mad and queer artist and advocate from so-called Western Massachusetts. Kevin's art and activism speaks to their lived experience within mental health in an unfiltered way. They exhibit a passionate effort towards making the world more accessible through client-led care, harm reduction and liberation-orientated care. Kevin uses their personal experience with ARFID, queerness and neurodivergence to support others navigating the same muddy waters. When they aren't engaging with the community, you can find Kevin hammocking in the woods, creating art or messing around with their two cats, which we speak about a lot in this podcast.
Hello.
Hello. Good morning.
Good morning indeed. What time is it where you are?
6 a.m., baby.
What are you doing?
I love the morning.
Really?
I've been up for 2 hours. I don't really know what I'm doing. It's a great question. Great question.
That is mad. At what time do you go to bed?
Like 8 or 9.
Okay. So yeah. You shift your day. To be fair, I've been up since 6 a.m. this time. Well, my
See?
Time.
See?
Yeah. I totally get it. I'm so much more of a morning person, so I actually get so much done in the morning, and then in the evening, you can just chill out and go to bed. Like, what's better than that?
Yeah, exactly. I love watching the sunrise. I haven't done it because I hurt my ankles last week, so I haven't been able to do it. But I usually am, like, out of the house at 5:30 to watch the sunrise.
Wow.
Yeah.
That is gorgeous. Do you know, I controversially actually think I'm a bigger fan of the sunset.
See, everyone says that, but, like, there's nobody at the park at 5:30 in the morning. Like, I'm alone watching the sunrise.
That is true.
But everyone watches the sunset. So I think sunsets are overrated.
I think I just like the fact that when it's a sunset, I can sit with a cocktail.
There. Yeah, I go for the coffee in the morning. So.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So for the listeners, do you want to introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, sure. My name is Kevin. My pronouns are they, them. I am just like a peer support advocate doing like ARFID advocacy, talking a lot about like client-led care and harm reduction, and like how that ties into neurodiversity, and all of that cool jazz, cool stuff. Yeah, I live out in Western Massachusetts, with me, my fiance and our two cats.
Fiance.
Yes. We get married in a month. Yeah.
Oh, that is so exciting.
Yes. A month tomorrow. So, yeah, maybe next time we chat, it will be husband. But,
yeah. Can I ask a really important question?
Yes.
Are the cats coming to the wedding?
No, but no, it's okay though, because, Heth, my fiance, his maid of honor got the fat heads of the cats. So we have like 2 or 3 foot giant blow ups of their heads that are just going to be like in the audience. So like they're there, but not there, but they're there. Don't worry.
It's the best thing I've ever heard.
Yeah.
Wow. Did you say 2 or 3 foot?
Yeah, 2 or 3 foot. They're giant. They're just, yeah. And we didn't tell our photographer that we have them. So it's about to be, so they'll be there in spirit. And
Wow. This is amazing, because I've seen, so obviously, as you know, I also have cats. That's how we first bonded. And I have seen like a lot of friends, they want to have pieces, like they want to have their cats there. But obviously, I think it would actually be way more stressful for a cat to go to a wedding than you would anticipate. And also the person that's going to have to like cat sit for them for the day would be tricky. But I've seen a lot of people do things like they'll have their cat on their cake toppers, or they'll have like the names of the tables named after things that their cats like or whatever. But a 3 foot blow up of a cat, I've never heard.
It's gonna be so fun. I don't think anyone's expecting it. The wedding
Does
party.
Does anyone know?
Just the wedding party. So, like 8 of us. Nobody else knows.
Oh my god, I absolutely love it. Okay, I'm so distracted right now because I want to ask so much more about they blow up cats. But that's just absolutely incredible. It's given me so many ideas. I can't wait to tell my partner later and be like, oh, so I did this podcast today and I've got a great idea for when we get married. Do you know what I'm thinking as well is at Christmas time, like, you know how it's big in America, isn't it? Like putting blow up things on your lawn. You could have that and then like decorate them in Christmas decorations.
I was just going to say, I have a giant roll of paper. I can make them little Santa hats and then masks for Halloween.
Oh my God. This is the best thing I've heard. This has made my mood so much better today. Oh my God. Yeah, every season, just crack out your different decorations.
Yeah, who needs like a lawn decoration when you have 3-foot cats?
Oh, Jesus Christ. Okay, well, everybody, I hope that you're very much enjoying this conversation as much as we clearly are. So to get to what we were going to chat about today, which I just feel is so inappropriate now, I just want to talk about cats. So, Arfid. People listening who haven't heard of Arfid, and hopefully, you know, people that regularly listen to the podcast, hopefully they have, because I think I did a podcast with your friend Brittany the other day, and we've done different podcasts too. But I guess from your sense, how would you describe Arfid?
Yeah. So I always break up Arfid into like three subtypes, but before I even like break that up, I usually break it into two different categories into like, I got this from like birth and it's like part of my neurodivergence. And then like, this is trauma related. And like, this happened past birth. I didn't always have Arfid. But then when we talk about like the actual Arfid, it's broken into three categories. It also stands for avoided restrictive food intake disorder. Should have led with that. So the three other subtypes, once you figure out which kind of category you can fall into, if you want to, you have the fear of aversive consequences. So these folks are like super afraid of getting sick or choking. People I work with a lot, it tends to be like, that's like the trauma is like, I choked on this thing as a kid, or like this happened at this event and that food was there kind of situation. A lot of autistic kids will like be forced to go to feeding therapy, which then that kind of leads to like the trauma aspect of it. And then you have sensory. There's a bunch of different ways people say it. Sensory issues. So these folks are like very sensitive to like textures and smells and flavors. And there's like super tasting, which is so fun and not enough people know about it, but you can buy test strips online. Super tasting means you just have like double the taste buds on your tongue. Yeah. And you can buy the strips online. And if it tastes gross and chemically, you're a super taster, and it tastes like you're licking a piece of paper, you're not. So that's another aspect that plays into like the sensory part for a lot of people is like, for me personally, I like if you make a smoothie in the blender and then the next day you try to make like, I blend my sauces. So let's say you tried to blend like a red sauce. I'm going to taste everything from the smoothie and everything from the red sauce because my taste buds are just doubled and a little activated. But then we also have the last one is just lack of interest. So these folks, sometimes it's just a general like food doesn't interest me. Like I just, nothing about it is interesting. And then other times it ties into like a lot of like the introspective skills of like, I don't get hunger cues. A lot of people I work with just don't get hunger cues as just like, and everyone always ties that to like, it's an eating disorder. It's like, yes. And the dialect of it all is like, it can also just a lot of neurodivergent people don't have like hunger cues or like, I don't know when until I go to the bathroom until it's like the last second. I'm like, oh, it's been like 6 hours since I've like taken care of my body. So those are the three different subtypes. You can have a mixture of them all, one or two of them, three of them. And we don't always like fall neatly into it. It's just like how the DSM has like decided things are broken up. But obviously every like presentation is very different. But that's a very long but short definition of ARFID.
Yeah, it's interesting what you say there about the DSM, you know, kind of that's how they've categorized it, because I think that's the same with, you know, eating disorders in general, is that, you know, nobody kind of fits perfectly into the neat little box, which then, you know, makes it tricky when you're struggling yourself to be like, oh, where do I fit and things like that. But I mean, I guess the argument that clinicians tend to have is that it's needed in order to provide treatment and medication. But I don't know where I sit on that. But something I wanted to ask you about ARFID, and kind of, I guess the things that you were kind of mentioning in terms of the consequences or the sensory input and the super tasting, and then also that lack of interest, they do, all of them do sound, I guess, like traits that you would maybe see in somebody that's neurodivergent. Do you think that ARFID is exclusively in individuals that are neurodivergent, or could you be neurotypical but still experience ARFID?
Yeah, I don't think it's exclusive for neurodivergent people. There's often arguments like online, mostly on like when I post a lot of posts that I make, people are like, well, that's not my experience. And it's like, well, yes, that's because everybody is different and we're all doing different things. But no, I think there's definitely like a huge, huge like connection. And I definitely think that like a lot of people that are neurodivergent experience like a lot of the experience of ARFID, but I don't think it's like mutually exclusive, especially when we think of like people who have been through like trauma later in life that like aren't neurodivergent. They just like experience trauma. I don't think those people would agree with that statement, but I think a large population. I don't know if there's been any like research or anything done on it to give like exact numbers, but I do think there's a large overlap, but not like 100% overlap, you know.
Personally, completely agree. Within research, there's been a lot of talk about how there's a big link between things like autism and ARFID, and people that listen to the podcast probably don't want to stop going on about this for the zillionth time, but I think it's really important to say in case people haven't heard it before, in that my hypothesis about that is that if somebody has autism, they're more likely to go to the doctor to get an assessment and a diagnosis to then get treatment for the autism or to get support for the autism. And then maybe the ARFID is picked up because they're working with people that understand ARFID. However, if you had somebody that only had ARFID and was neurotypical, they're more likely, people are just like, you're just a fussy eater. Like, you just need to be more diverse with the food that you eat. So they're not necessarily going to go to a doctor. So I think that's why we maybe think, or we see more people that are autistic with ARFID than neurotypical with ARFID, because people maybe aren't going to go and get the support and the treatment that they need.
Yeah. It's either that, or the flip of it is like my experience and so many other people's experience, where we go and we try to get treatment. We know we have ARFID, we don't have the language for it. But then as soon as you're like, oh yeah, I also struggle with body image, then it's like, oh, okay, then you're anorexic or you have ARFID, and like no ARFID here. So like my experience was going to treatment in 2020 and being diagnosed with the wrong thing, treated for the wrong thing, added like a bunch of trauma on top of the trauma I already had with food. And then I got out and somebody, another dietitian I was working with, was like, oh yeah, they missed that completely. Because the DSM is just like, oh yeah, no body images whatsoever, no body image issues whatsoever, which like I could go on a rant about how silly that is when you then again look at the overlap of like autism and like queerness and ARFID, and like how ridiculous it is to be like, yeah, you're not allowed to hate your body and have this diagnosis. So I think it's those two things. It's either like you're supposed to be a kid and like outgrow it, or like be autistic and have it, or it's the that thought. But yeah, I feel like those are the main two reasons that people aren't getting like diagnosed with it or not figuring it out until they go online and then they hear people talking about it and they're like, oh shit, there you go.
I have that. It's interesting what you say about body image. I want to ask you a bit more about that, because I, you know, when people kind of make like educational posts or whatever, they will often say that ARFID is, you know, it's the eating disorder that's unrelated to body image. So whereas, you know, the other anorexia, bulimia, binge eating disorder, the primary factor potentially is body image, which also is just a massive overstatement, because even with those eating disorders, it's not necessarily just down to body image. How does body image interplay into your ARFID? Is it something just, they're not actually connected, you're not kind of engaging in the ARFID behaviors to navigate your body image, it's just you have body image struggles alongside having ARFID? Or does the ARFID other behaviors and attempt to change or improve your body image?
Yeah, I think it's complicated. And I obviously can only speak for myself, but like, first you have like the layer of like, I am trans, I am queer. So like already like one strike against me, and that, and we could go into the conversation of like how many trans people have to like lose, forced into losing weight so they can like have surgeries and like get gender affirming care, which then forces you into having an eating disorder. So that's a whole conversation within itself. But for me and like my experiences are like, when I do experience like hunger cues or like fullness cues, it's so extreme that like my body is just uncomfortable. And when I experience like, when I'm afraid that I'm gonna like choke or get really sick when I'm eating something, like my stomach hurts really bad. So like the physical sensations that come with ARFID and like the anxiety of ARFID, at least for me, manifests in like a very physical way that like makes it really difficult to like be in my body, because it's like, okay, am I gonna like get really sick? Am I just anxious? Am I hungry? Like, I don't know how, what, like what cue is what. But I also think like when I'm like in a solid spot, like right now, like I am chill in my body and like it is what it is. But when things are tougher and like I'm like eating differently or like eating less or like not getting outside as much, and like my body does just feel like different, like I'm just not moving it in a way that feels good, and like I'm not doing what feels good, and that kind of ties in. I don't think my ARFID has ever been tied to like be smaller to fit into society, because society is gross. But I do think it ties into the, like the physical aspect of eating is uncomfortable, and like existing in my body while eating is uncomfortable. So I think it's just like a different kind of body image issues. It's not like I need to be tiny because that's the best thing to be in the world. It's just like the actual physical parts of eating are so distressing. And a lot of people I work with ARFID, it's either like a trauma response in your body, that's a lot to handle. So it's like, you could say that that's like a body image issue, is like the physical, like feeling connected to your body. You could say that that is like tied to body image. But I think the biggest thing is like the crossover between like queerness and neurodivergency and ARFID. It's like, you cannot like expect a group of people that already are like forced into not liking their body to like magically like their body so they're allowed to like access this specific diagnosis. I definitely like have worked with dozens of people that like love their body and have ARFID, so like, yeah, it is possible. And it's also possible to like despise your body and still have ARFID, you know. And I think it just depends on the person. I've worked with a lot of people that's like, yeah, I don't like when my clothes feel tight and like feeling uncomfortable and like that kind of sensory aspect. But I think it's super individual. And I think it's super unfair to just be like, yeah, you're not allowed to experience this thing in a society that like pushes everyone to hate themselves, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think it's so interesting what you were saying there. And that was actually what I was going to come back to, was that sensory kind of overstimulation in your body. And I wanted to ask you, you know, do you think that's a part of it that's almost linked to the neurodivergence? Because I know that for me, I only got diagnosed with ADHD just over 3 months ago. But it's been, I also think that maybe I'm autistic, but I don't know what it's like in the US, but it's impossible to get a diagnosis. I mean, I think it's 8 years or something for a diagnosis at the moment, or it's like $2,000 for an autism diagnosis. So yes. I'm just living with the self-diagnosis at the moment because it's a lot cheaper. But something I found is that has massively fed into my eating disorder and body dysmorphia is the fact that, you know, being in my body just feels really uncomfortable sometimes. Like the feelings of the texture of clothing on my skin just feels so awful sometimes. And then only now that I've kind of got that understanding of, oh, I might struggle with sensory issues, it's like, ah, well, okay, then I don't need to restrict now, because I understand that that's potentially the issue. Or, you know, I don't want my, and I think that's why the body dysmorphia has kind of been amplified. So I wondered from your perspective, if that's what you thought about those like sensory issues in terms of being in your body is maybe linked to the neurodivergence.
Yeah, I definitely think so. I know for like Me and my fiance, we always joke we have like our outside clothes and like the clothes we like Heth wears to his job, his outside people clothes. And like I wear like, I like looking nice when like I go out, but like when I'm at home, I'm just in like the biggest sweatshirt I own and like the comfiest pants. And like, because, and everyone's always like, it's always like, you're trying to hide your body, you don't like your body. And it's like, no, if I feel one more inch of fabric touching my skin, yes, I'm going to crawl out of it. Yeah. And especially like in the summertime. And it's just like, you cannot take off your skin. And like when I'm sweaty and I'm hot and I'm overstimulated, like that's all I want to do. And it's like, I feel like my outfit is usually worse in the summertime because it's like I'm already over, the second I wake up and I'm sweaty, I'm already overstimulated. Like I'm already done for the day. Yeah. So yeah, I think it ties, I think it all ties in. And like I, like the physical, like most people can't feel their food, like digesting, but like neurodivergent people, like I can truly feel my food traveling like all the way down my throat into my stomach. And like I experience all the feelings. And like when I get, a few years ago, I was in the hospital and they were doing like some kind of IV thing. And I was like, wow, that's really uncomfortable. Like I could feel it in my veins. And they're like, no, you can't. I was like, don't invalidate my, like, I'm telling you, I can feel the thing in my body. So I think when you're like hypervigilant and like feel every single part of your body, it's like, well, obviously you're going to have like body image issues. Like you're hyper focused on the thing that you have to live in. And it's like, also extra sucks because usually the thing that like calms down my neurodivergent brain is like having an ounce of control and like being able to change a situation when it's uncomfortable. And it's like, nope, this is my skin. Like I'm stuck in it. Mm-hmm. And I think that coming to that realization too, like contributes to the body image issues. Like usually it's like, work on it, love yourself, yada, yada. It's like, no, I'm just like stuck in it. So I would rather just like ignore that I exist, like do not perceive me. I'm just going to be in big comfy stuff. So yeah, I think it ties, I think there's so many different like crossovers and ties, but I think the like eating disorder world only sees it as like, oh, you only have body image issues if you just like want to be tiny and like fit into the mold that society has made. And it's like, I don't know, I think any like disliking of your body can like qualify that. I don't think there's like one way to like have body dysmorphia or anything like that, you know.
Yeah. Firstly, what you said about the heat yesterday in Cambridge, it was 34 degrees Celsius, which to people around the world may not be very hot, but to us Brits that is literally, I am in an oven. So I've been really struggling in the heat. And I actually, as you were talking, that you might have seen me shed a little tear, because you're the first person that I've ever spoken to that's explained it exactly how I would explain it in terms of the feeling of fabric on your skin. And you know, I struggle so much when I eat, when I feel it, mm-hmm, within me, and you can't do anything about that. And like you say, that lack of control. And yeah, I just wanted to thank you for saying it and articulating it so well, because it's something I'm definitely learning at the moment. And I think because I haven't had that sort of understanding of neurodivergence, I've just been like, oh, I'm trying to fit my body into a smaller size to be accepted by society. And actually, no, I actually like the way that my body looks. I'm trying to wear these baggy clothes because I feel so fucking stimulated when fabric touches me. And when I'm eating, I can feel every inch of it. And that's what's making me uncomfortable, not the fact that I'm not stick thin anymore.
Yeah, yeah. And I think there's always the argument of like, I hate when people are like, one bite at a time, like one meal at a time. And it's like, yes, I understand. And this is forever. Like, we always have to eat. This is never going to like stop. And then I get the like, well, stop being so like pessimistic, da da da. And it's like, first of all, I'm like just autistic. That's just how my brain works. But it's like true, like stop trying to like invalidate, like no, this is forever. Like this is a forever thing. I always will have to like, I'm always just gonna have to eat. And I hate the like mentality of like, well, it's gonna get better eventually, you just gotta do one thing at a time. And it's like, please, like stop, like just validate that sometimes it just fucking sucks. And like that's life. I don't know, I don't think it's like being negative, I think it's validating experiences, you know.
Yeah, I think, you know, having the reality of, you know, you're going to have days where it sucks. You might have months where it sucks. Like there's going to be times where it is difficult and uncomfortable. But equally, there are going to be times that are shit, but there are going to be times that are good as well. And, you know, all of this is a learning process in terms of, okay, you know, you're really struggling right now. And one thing that really helps me is things like a weighted blanket or like having my cat sit on my lap or whatever. Well, in 34 degree heat, you do not want a weighted blanket or cats on you. And they also don't want to be on you either. So I think that then makes it difficult when you've maybe not got those things that you normally lean into. But honestly, hearing you kind of explain it in such a articulate way and just being like, because I think that's one thing I really struggle with as well. And we'll come back on to what we were talking about before, but is when I say to somebody, when they're like, why are you crying or why are you freaking out? And I'm like, the fabric on my clothes feels weird. And people are like, the fuck? Have you seen that there's war zones and things out there and you're crying over but fabric on your skin? And it is so, like you say, it's so invalidating. Mm-hmm. But you can't explain the intensity of how you're feeling. So to hear somebody say, I get you, it's like, whoa, holy shit.
Yeah, I got you. Yeah. And like going back to the like, it's been, I go to this, provider support group that my friend Jenny runs. So it's just like a support group for people providing support to other people. And I was going off one day about like, mm-hmm. I was trying to eat this muffin and I was like, just eat the fucking muffin, Kevin. Like you've eaten muffins before. You like muffins. Just do the thing. Like, why is it so difficult? And somebody interrupted me and was like, Kevin, like it's been hard before and it's been easy before. So that's just kind of been the thing that like I've been holding on to and telling people that like, yeah, sometimes it sucks and also sometimes it doesn't suck. So like trying to hold on to that dialectic of like, yep, been hard before and it's been super easy before. And just like having that on literal repeat in my head.
Yeah, absolutely. No, that's a really good perspective. I think holding on to the fact that you have managed it before, but equally it was hard at one point as well. And something I wanted to chat more to you about was, I can't remember whether you just said that it was body image issues, but I think when we spoke before, you had spoken about within the trans community how ARFID is quite common, or there's quite a large prevalence of it. And I was just wondering from your perspective, like why you maybe thought that was.
Yeah. Well, I think the first thing is like what I was sharing about like queer people just have to like they just are forced into like losing weight and like developing eating disorders just to be able to access care, which in within itself is just like a traumatic experience. But I don't know, the crossover, I mean, when we look at like the autistic neurodivergent community, I already think the crossover between like queer people and that is so large. And we already know that like eating disorders are more prevalent in queer communities and in autistic communities. So I don't know. I think the research just kind of leads me to believe that like when we match those two things together. But yeah, I don't know what the crossover is, but I think it's just like the neurodivergence tie to the queer community, and then like literally being forced. Like when I wanted top surgery, I didn't have to lose a significant amount of weight, but they were like, it would quote be safer if like you lost X weight until we did this. So I think that's the biggest piece, is like literally being forced into developing eating disorders so that queer people can access care. But I also think just like we were just talking about, like the trauma of existing in a body, period. pretty also traumatic to exist in a body when you're queer or trans and like trying to navigate a world that like hates you and like does not want you to exist. But yeah, I don't really know what the crossover is. I think it's just like when we look at the crossover of neurodivergence and ARFID, it's just the queer community is just so prevalent. It's just such a big crossover. And I wish there was more. I mean, I wish there was more research on ARFID as a whole, but I wish there was more research on like the populations it's affecting, you know?
Yeah. I mean, it makes sense, like you say, if you look at kind of the areas where ARFID is more prevalent. And I mean, this isn't related to eating disorders, but not everything on this podcast needs to be. But why, if you have any thoughts, do you think that neurodivergence is more common in the queer community?
I don't really know. I feel like it's part like we're just like I don't know. I hate the argument of like, this is a new thing. This didn't exist when I existed. It's like, yeah, because people didn't feel safe. And like, yeah, there weren't like the resources, Grandpa. Like when there was world wars happening, like nobody was doing autism assessments. So I think that's a big part of it. I don't know though. Like, I just think, especially when we look at like the neurodivergent part, it's just like, being autistic just comes with so many of the sensory issues. It's like, I don't know many. I do know autistic people without ARFID, but I don't know many without like some correlation to like food issues and like sensitivity. I think it's part just like autistic people or queer people are just like, not all of us, but most of us are just like so open to just like knowing who we are or like exploring who we are and like not holding back. Like, I know a lot of queer people that, like, kind of knew they had, like, an issue with food in, like, childhood or teenagehood when they knew that they were, like, queer and just, like, exploring all these identities. And I think, like, obviously, again, can't, like, say big 100% answers, but I know, like, a lot of people have messaged me on my Instagram who, like, aren't in the queer community and are like, holy shit, like, nobody has ever talked to me about, like, identity or food. Like, it's just never come up. And then later on I've learned that, like, being on Instagram, that like I am queer, like I do have ARFID, and like, so I think it's just like access to information and like access to community, and then just again the weird, like, what are they, Venn diagrams, like a triple fucking Venn diagram, and in the middle is just ARFID. But yeah, again, I don't know, it's just such, I think it's all those aspects of just like knowing ourselves and exploring things and like the access to information within itself.
Yeah. Do you know, I think that you, something that you said that I thought was really poignant was when you are neurodivergent or you've had an eating disorder, you have to really look inside yourself, and through therapy and things like that, you have to take a lot of time to learn about yourself, reflect on things, da da da. And maybe the process of that, in terms of really looking into the person that you are and really exploring that, that might be when things like, you know, exploring your sexuality or your gender also come up. Whereas if maybe you don't have that intense time to think about yourself and you kind of just like glide on through life, you maybe don't take a step to think, you know, what is actually going on with my sexuality or what's going on with my gender here? Not to say that, you know, in order to figure out that you're trans or whatever, you have to do deep exploration, because I feel like it is probably one of those things that you know, but maybe if you don't give it the time to explore it, then it's not something that you kind of, I think because of the way that society is, it's not kind of the thing that you would just be like, I'm trans. It's kind of something that you kind of take time to think about and explore and what have you. So maybe that's why it feels more prevalent, is because people are taking that time to explore themselves in different ways.
I thinking of, like, I had my bachelor, we had our bachelor party this past weekend, and everybody was inside and my friend came out and we were sitting outside hanging out, and they were like, all your friends are so cool, like I've never been in like a group of people that like have understood everything I've said. And I was like, that's because that whole house is full of neurodivergent people. It's like your friend group is like, you're the only neurodivergent person in your friend group. But they were literally like tears in their eyes, because they were like, holy shit, like everything everybody was saying, it was so relatable. And like, I didn't feel like I had to like hide and like mask who I was. And I was like, yeah, it's like when we lean into community and we find community, that's literally life saving. And like, that's what's changing. And like, it's wild that like my bachelor party was like, so many just like queer neurodivergent people that like we talked about our feelings and like talked about hard things and like in between obviously talking about like the wedding and like fun things. But there's such like just a guard down when you're like in a safe, like when you're in a cabin in the woods with like eight neurodivergent people, like you're probably gonna discover some shit about yourself, because everybody else is also just like there being their authentic self. So I definitely think having access to community is super important. Like, I've met older queer people that are like, yeah, I literally didn't even come out until like I was 50 or 60 because there wasn't the community. Or like, I don't know if you saw, but a very this guy who served in the military over here in the United States, he passed away a few weeks ago, and he came out in his obituary because he had no idea how to like come out and like tell people he was queer. And like in his obituary, he was like, yeah, I was in this very long relationship with this man that I loved. And like when he passed away, it was just me. And like, I was a widow, but I couldn't tell anyone I was a widow. So like literally came out in his obituary because he didn't have like the community. So I always say that like community is going to save our lives. And like, I think having community, I probably wouldn't have discovered that I was like queer or like more leaning into like the femme side of things later in life. And like, I wouldn't have discovered that like I am polyam and like all these other things if it wasn't for like the community that has like catched me, which it's like a very big privilege to have community. And I think that's like not only life-saving, but like gives you the information and like connection to like make these bigger discoveries, you know?
Yeah, no, I think that, I think you're so right. I think the power of seeing someone else be true to themselves and be mm-hmm. their authentic self, seeing that, I moved to Cambridge about 5 years ago, and I was really, really fortunate that I made friends with my, she's still my best friend, but she lives in New York, which is not fun because that's very far away. But she massively opened my eyes to, I'd come from, you know, a white middle class kind of very kind of straight laced family, and she really opened my eyes to the diversity in life, and not just kind of, you know, neurodivergence, but also people from different backgrounds, different cultures. You know, she is herself polyamorous, and that was something that I'd never kind of experienced, and I remember being so grateful to her for, I like looked up to her so much. And I think a lot of the time people are really scared to go there themselves. They're like, oh, like that, you know, I don't want to kind of unravel myself and look deeper because they're scared of what they might find. But then equally, we admire people that do that work so much mm-hmm. because, and it's so refreshing to be around those people. And then actually through meeting her, she then introduced me to her friends. And honestly, you know, they're people from all different walks of life, but the one thing that they have in common is that they are all so emotionally intelligent, and it's been crazy and so inspiring to see them, you know, like all the kind of guys in the group, stereotypically from where I'm from, like guys don't talk about their emotions, and my partner when we first got together did quite struggle with talking about his emotions, and now he'll come downstairs and he's like, I'm feeling this way and that way and da 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 da, and I'm like, yes, like,
hell yeah.
Let's do this, let's talk about how we're feeling, because it makes life so much easier. But it's difficult when you know come from a place where that's kind of, you know, looked down on or whatever, which is complete tangent, but I think basically what I was trying to say there was, you know, I think it is so important to find those people that help you to want to be your authentic self, and they really encourage that as well, which is why it sounds so nice that you've got that group of people who, you know, talk and share. Because often when I had a friend who got an ADHD diagnosis just before I did, and I would have not got the diagnosis if it wasn't for her. And it was understanding how I was like, but why do you need the diagnosis? Like, you know, you've got your own quirks and you deal with them. And she's like, I don't deal with them, and you don't deal with yours either. And I was like, meh. Well, yeah. Someone's called me out.
Caught me there. Yeah. I think community is, there's been so many friends that like we've become friends, and then later on they're like, hey, I think I'm autistic, or I think I have autism. I'm like, yeah, I've just been waiting for you to come to that conclusion, babe.
Absolutely. Yeah. So I guess, Kevin, to finish us off, if someone's been listening to this podcast, I mean, one thing I think people are going to want to listen to this just because we've had such a great chat, they're going to be sat here thinking, I want this to be my community. What would your advice be if people are looking to maybe explore things about themselves but really not sure where to start?
Yeah, I'm a big online person. I think finding like the right things online is kind of difficult, but I always suggest to people to like start in, like, not to toot my own horn, but I'm always like, look who I follow, and like kind mm-hmm. of just base off of that, and then like find somebody that somebody follows and just kind of keep going on that train. I always say be obviously very weary about like pro eating disorder stuff and like trans med people and like weird community that is very gatekeepy. But I also think just like finding your community, and then also just like being very open to like reaching out and just like trying to make connections, because
I personally will, like, I reply to every message on Instagram. Like, I'm very active online and, like, am very, very interested in, like, getting people connected to community. So I think just, like, being open and, like, replying to people's stories and, like, engaging and sharing things, is literally how I've started most of my community online. It's just, like, hyping other people up and then, like, slowly, hyping people up and then, like, maybe collabing with them or, like, chatting about things that they've posted about, and just kind of letting things bud from there. But also, there are, once you, like, start looking around, there are, like, queer dropping groups or, like, eating disorder dropping groups, and, like, a bunch of community oriented, like, Discord servers are really a good place to go and find community. But I think if you find one person, like, I don't know. I think if you find one person, I'm thinking of, like, once I became friends with my friend Jenny, it was just kind of like Jenny introduced me to all her friends, and then those people introduced me to people. So I think it's really finding, like, one person and connecting with them and being really open, like, I need more community, or, like, I would love to be more involved in X, Y, and Z. And then, like, going to these events and, like, going to, like, Instagram lives and connecting with people there, is usually what I suggest to people. There's also, like, I don't know, I think online is a really good place to start. There's also, like, queer, like, near me, there's the Brick House, which is, like, a queer community center. And I'm pretty sure they have, like, bulletin boards with, like, a bunch of resources. So that's a good place too, is, like, finding community support. I know, like, Tapestry and, like, Planned Parenthood, of course, those are local to me. I don't know if they exist other places, but finding, like, queer clinics, like health clinics, and being like, I'm really looking for community, they should have resources too. So I think it's a lot all to say, like, finding one person that you think might have other resources and just kind of letting it fall down from there. But yeah, I don't know. I think you can find community in so many places. I've just been sticking to, like, the online community, especially since COVID started. And I think it's just easier for neurodivergent people to exist online. But yeah, those are my few suggestions.
Yeah, I think one thing that I found really important as well in kind of building that community is being true to myself. I found once I was like, once I, and it's really difficult to do, but once I put away that mask and stopped pretending to be somebody that I wasn't, I actually then started making really good connections and friendships because I was actually being the person that I am. And so I felt safe and comfortable. And I was like, oh, I don't feel like I'm gonna, you know, I'm not dreading this event now because I've got to pretend to be somebody else. I'm actually going and chilling out with them and being me. And that's not as tiring as, you know, putting on this whole new personality that is nothing like the person that I am. So
Yeah,
I
I
think.
think I, like, often remind myself, I'm always like, your friends want to be your friends. Like, they want you. They want to be Kevin's friend. But yeah, I think the unmasking takes a while. And I now have friends that, like, when I FaceTime them, they'll message me later and be like, I just love how you're just, like, stimming and running around the house and, like, acting like you're still interacting with me, but you're not just, like, sitting in a chair just, like, masking and just, like, staying still. You're just, like, doing you, and, like, I'll pop in with the cats and then I'm coming back and then I'm back in, like, a different outfit, and people are like, what the fuck? And it's just like, I don't know, you decided to be my friend, which now means you get to see me unmasked. Which,
Exactly.
again, I think there's also worth saying that, like, being able to unmask is such a huge privilege, and, like, takes a lot of work. But I always like to add the note that, like, it's so much privilege to be able to, like, run around and be just a silly little fella. And I do feel so much more, like you said, so much more free. It's not like I used to come home from school and, like, get in my comfy clothes and just, like, have a meltdown every day because I just masked for 9 hours and, like, everything is terrible, and then go to bed and wake up and do it again. It's like, no, now I come home and I, like, run around in my boxers and make lots of weird noises and, like, chase my cats around and, like, I just do me, and, like, that's a lot more freeing. Highly suggest.
Yeah, that's so funny because literally before this podcast I was, well, I was trying to cool down, but I don't know why I did this. Instead, I just danced around the kitchen with the dogs that I'm sitting for to loud, like, drum and bass music, and it didn't cool me down at all, but it made me feel really happy. So
Yeah, I love talking about, which we can chat about another time, but, like, the connect. I love when people are like, Kevin, you hate loud noises, but you blast music as loud as you can. I'm like, shut the fuck up. Yeah, I don't understand it, but I do it.
I hate it when the loud noises are something I can't control.
Yes.
And actually, it was so funny the other day. I put the Olympics on in the background. And normally, if I had like noise on in the background, like I would get really distracted. Like I can't work in cafes. But the Olympics, I think because everyone was cheering and like hyping everyone up. Oh my God, I got so much work done. It was amazing. I was like, I don't need to have sport on in the background. I don't want to watch the sport, but I just want to have the noise.
I need the cheering.
Yes. Go ahead.
I was just gonna say, I feel like you can just like YouTube search cheering.
Cheerleaders shouting Hannah.
You need like a like the iCarly remote where you can push a button every time you get like an answer done and it just starts clapping for you. Lights start popping out.
Literally. Oh dear. Well, Kevin, thank you so much. It's been an absolute pleasure to chat to you. This has been the joy of my week. So thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Of course. Thanks for having me. It was so much fun.
If you enjoyed listening today, you won't want to miss next week's episode. So be sure to subscribe. Eating disorders are crippling illnesses, but with the right support, they can be recovered from. We really hope you enjoyed this episode, but if you require more support right now, please look into charities such as First Steps and Beat for support, or talk to someone you trust.